The 210, the 605, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the 210, the freeways are not so nice. The 101, the 405, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the I-10, the freeways are not so nice. The 210, the 605, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the I-10, the freeways are not so nice. The red light.
I'm gonna let the whole song.
The red light! The red light! The red light! The red light! The 210, the 605, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the I-10, the freeways are not so nice. The 101, the 405, the freeways are not so nice. The 605, the 101, the 101, the 101! The I-10, the 210, the 605, the 101, the 405, the I-10, the freeways are not so nice. The red light, 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 the red light.
Good evening, Los Angeles. Welcome to episode 11 of Los Angeles Nista. I am your host, producer, and creator of the show, Eduardo Emiliano Solis. My birth name tonight. Call us 1-800-893-9562. That is 800-893-9562. Great show tonight. We got Martin Wong of Giant Robot. That magazine is a huge, huge, gigantic component to LA culture. In the 90s, I was totally immersed in it. It had graffiti and kung fu movies and skateboarding and music. Great stuff. I'm excited he's here. But I also wanted to let everyone know what's going on in February. It's a huge, huge, gigantic month. Not only do we have Martin Wong here tonight of Giant Robot, February 4th, episode 11, but next week, on the 11th, we got Fredo Ortiz from the band The Bongoloids, who has a huge history in music that actually spans from Los Lobos to Tenacious D to Beastie Boys. And on the 18th, we got the iconic photography legend, Ed Culver, who is known for his photography work and manifesting album covers from the Chili Peppers. That's right, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Black Flag, The Damage cover, Circle Jerks, X, Fear, and Wasted Youth. Super stoked. And we all know Dave Grohl has a new movie out that he put together called Sound City, which is based on the studio in Van Nuys called Sound City. And he put together a movie called Sound City Movie. Producer Jim, well, actually James Rhoda, he's going to be coming in on the last Monday of February, which is February 25th. And that's going to be a great episode. Last week was amazing. Pro skater Mike Vallely, Mike V, I mean, the guy was such a huge influence on me growing up. And, you know, he's just so active doing music, acting. He was in movies like The Hangover. Now he's got a new movie, or actually a new band called Good For You with founder of SST and creator of Black Flag, Greg Ginn. They're going to be doing shows. Their record comes out February 26th. Mike's new stuff is great. He's got a new skate company. And everyone out there, if you haven't heard last week's episode with Mike V, please go to the website or iTunes and download that episode. It was amazing. So when we come back, we're going to have Martin Wong from Giant Robot. We're going to go into a block of Mike's new band, Good For You, and get into the new stuff. All right, here it is. Thank you.
Without you, without you, without you, I don't. myself.
Welcome back to Los Angeles Nista. I'm Edward Solis, your host. And that was a new group called Good For You, which is made up of vocalist Mike V, who was my guest last week. Mike V, the professional skateboarder, real name Mike Vallely. And on guitar is Greg Ginn, founder of SST Records and creator of Black Flag. The band is called Good For You. We just heard three tracks. Their new record, Life's Too Short Not to Hold a Grudge, coming out February 26th on vinyl and download. And welcome to episode 11 of Los Angeles Nista. My in-studio guest, right across from me, Giant Robots, Martin Wong.
Hi.
Martin, thank you for coming tonight.
Oh, man, I'm super psyched that you would invite me. You've had such heavyweights, man, from...
Well, you know what?
Lately and Dukowski and now me.
No. I need to interrupt you because what you did with Giant Robot throughout the 90s... was so heavy to me, and the way that you seamlessly gelled all the subcultures of Los Angeles, skateboarding, graffiti, music, hardcore, hip hop, everything, and the toys. That was just like a big, broad representation of how people are brought up with this melting pot of cultures. So your work, that component, Giant Robot, it's just like, it matters, man. So thank you.
Well, no, first of all, I got to say that my buddy Eric Nakamura, started the magazine. We started it together.
Yeah.
And man, he was like, you know, as Ginn is to SST and Black Flag, that's him to Giant Robot. You know,
okay.
It's all his brainchild and his business sense and his sense of changing the world. And I was like the Dukowski who was just like behind him
plowing
from the start and just, you know, plowing all the way through. So, yeah, I'm super psyched that you would recognize, I don't know, that you would know my name and stuff that most people don't.
Well, let's just, okay, we're going to spend the first hour talking about your history Giant Robot, and the second hour talking about the classic Los Angeles needs to format the public transportation in your neighborhood of choice, which is Silver Lake. So let's just get it started. So, I mean, as far as Giant Robot goes, tell us, how did you meet Eric?
You know, at the time, we're talking, I don't know, 1990 maybe, around then.
Okay.
Eric and I were like two of the only Asian dudes going to punk rock shows, like a Jabberjaw or right. UCLA Coop or whatever.
Who were some of the bands you saw at Jabberjaw?
Oh, man, everyone from... Seaweed, Rocket from the Crypt, The Dwarves,
right?
Bikini Kill, man, it just goes on and on and on. Phantom Surfers,
right?
You know, every single genre from, you know, the heaviest rock, you know, I think Godhead Silo maybe. Right. Oh, Nirvana, of course.
Oh, you saw Nirvana there?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, that was really amazing. Them to see a band like that or Bikini Kill, and like those are all really life-changing moments.
Exactly.
And Eric and I were like two of the only Asian guys there, and we both had kind of long hair. I mean, it was the early 90s.
Okay.
So like people would always confuse us for each other and like, oh, hi Eric. Oh, hi Mart. You know, like so
right.
Either you know, Eric and I tell the story, like either you have to become friends or you become enemies and never, you know, and you're the anti other person. So we became friends. And, you know, it worked out that we both were into like making zines about music.
Sure.
And then one day he said, man, I want to make a zine about Asian culture. And I said, me too. And it just started just like that.
Okay. So where did you guys operate out of?
His bedroom was the first one for sure. Like at his parents' house. Like it was a bedroom operation.
And literally. This is before like, you know, advanced computers where you could just do, you know, so much in so little time. So you were really part of like the analog way of doing things. Even though there was computers in the 90s, it's not as nearly as easy as it was now.
No, I'm glad you asked because, yeah, I mean, Eric was a photographer. He worked in a dark room. That was his day gig. And then my day gig was editing textbooks for McGraw-Hill. So he was pictures, I was words. You know, and everything kind of worked out that way. You know, we just like filled in a lot of each other's, you know, we filled in each other's gaps kind of.
Sure.
Both skill-wise, but also I think business-wise or taste-wise and a lot of other ways, you know, we just really meshed.
Gotcha.
And, you know, you got to have that for a magazine or any endeavor to last 16 years, you know, like our print magazine did.
Right.
Yeah, we had this great, amazing relationship. It was awesome. And, you know, we're still great friends to this day.
So that's great. So when you, okay, let's obviously when it's a DIY company and it's independent and you're doing it yourself, it's like, you know, endless days and nights and thankless weekends. It's just, you're just plowing through. Let's talk about when you would see Giant, let's kind of just catapult to the next phase. So when you guys were actually, you know, you're doing it in the garage, but you got a reputation. The magazine's being distributed. Like, when did you get the magazine widely distributed? What year was that?
Well, you know, the first issues were, you know, maybe edition of 200, 400.
Yep.
And we literally went, you know, we stapled and folded and collated around the dining table. And we'd go from store, you know, to different stores saying, hi, will you please carry my magazine? You know, we went to places like, I remember specific record stores.
Okay.
Like what, Benway maybe. You know, we tried Jabberjaw itself. It was under glass at Jabberjaw.
Right.
Golden Apple was a really early supporter.
Really?
Golden Apple Comics. Yeah. So, you know, we actually, it was like having a 7-inch or something, I guess, where you'd actually have to go distribute it yourself. But eventually Eric sent one to Tower Records, and the dude there is really into Asian boys. Like he goes on tours and stuff. Anyway, he really liked Giant Robot and Eric, and they talked for a long time, and that was our first distribution, you know, and like that was the first time Tower Records. We were on a bookshelf, you know, next to big magazines like Rolling Stone or whatever.
Right, right. And I do remember going to different Tower locations, whether it was the one on Sunset or the one that opened, I think there was one in Lakewood, you know, Long Beach, all over the place. There's tons of Tower stores. When you guys were actually able to get your product in Tower, how many did you have to manufacture to fulfill that?
Oh, man, that's, you know, Eric's the business guy, but I want to say we had like, you know, maybe issue 3 was the first time we went from being stapled and folded and photocopied to being larger size with a 2-color cover. You know, our distributor told us, you know, you got to make it larger so it shows up on the newsstand. And then we had all these friends that would do like indie comics. We had a lot of friends at this place called High Water Books. And other zine friends, you know, we would correspond with, and everyone would trade tips, like how you can do better, how you can increase your circulation, you know, make it full size, add color to your cover, add some color inside, you know, talk to these potential advertisers. And, you know, all of that, it was like this real scene of all these people trying to come up at the same time.
Right. Now, but when you were actually in Tower, did you know how many copies you were running off?
Oh, man. Like, more or less? It started off with like 2,000.
So it went from like 400 to 2,000.
Yeah, they were like good friends of independent publishers back then. Like, they had everything. They were the, and, you know, and I know that they would distribute us in places like Hawaii. Yeah, Japan. And that was huge. You know, like, we had a small but super dedicated, just totally into our topics, which changed as we grew and, you know, our readership grew too.
That's great. So, I mean, what would you consider the peak of Giant Robot?
You know, I don't really think about it in terms of readership or stores or whatever. It's a process. You know, I really loved, and this is going to sound cheesy, super cheesy, but just working in a bedroom or the garage, you know, all the time. And, you know, we'd just crank out magazine after magazine, and we'd meet these really interesting people, whether it's a Hong Kong movie star like Tony Leung or a total rock god like, I don't know, Herman Lee from Dragon Force or whatever.
Right.
You know, we're always just discovering and meeting new rad people, and they would introduce us to other new rad people, and it just went on and on and on. And the magazine's almost like an afterthought, you know?
I get it. It was more about living in the moment with the work in progress, it seems like, right?
Yeah, I feel like, you know, like if you're in your band, right, like your peak isn't when the record comes out. It's when you're making the music.
Sure.
And you're out of your mind, and you look back at it, you listen a year later, and you can't believe you did this stuff. Like, you know, you can't believe, whoa, I wrote an article about Asian coffee drinks, and I had Bill Stevenson, you know, review them.
Right.
You know, to come up, or we did Asian hot sauces, but instead of just having a taste test, we had Guar taste them in character. You know, like like things like that, I look back at, and I'm like, whoa, those were inspired. I can't believe we did that.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty unique and very, very admirable, actually, just the creativity behind the content you made.
Yeah, yeah. And then like there came a point where, you know, we started off with Japanese robot toys were super hot, and
sure,
you know, there's noise music, like the Boredoms were like just going off, and Hong Kong movies were just at the beginning, those were so hot. And then, but eventually, you know, those things come and go, and you just start to pick up on new things.
Sure.
And I felt like
maybe skateboarding.
Oh man, all the time. You know, there's so many people who are into designer toys or cool music. They like, you know, they'll like certain fashion, or they'll like listen to music, but it all comes from skateboarding, I swear.
I have to say it does. All fashion does.
Yeah, you know, fashion, music, politics, you know, it all, everything comes back to skateboarding. So it was really important to me to interview skateboarders and not just have, you know, oh, this streetwear guy, you know, or this band that's popular in
right.
videos.
Who are some of the skateboarders? I could think of some off the top of my head, but just some of your more memorable professional skateboard
experiences. You know, I visited Cab at in Scotts Valley, and I still keep in touch with them, kind of. And
you went up to his place?
Yeah, yeah. You know,
Tell me about that.
Oh, you know, well, you know, I was corresponding with him, and he's like a super huge Ultraman fan, it turns out. So he has this massive collection of Mego toys and Ultraman.
Huge toy collection,
so,
right?
Yeah, so he was really into Giant Robot and what we do. And he's also, you know, an artist. He's a painter and illustrator. So, and, you know, eventually he started drawing with Dave Cho and all these other dudes. And, you know, it's weird. Like, all these worlds collide through Giant Robot, and then, you know, actually, we're never part of it.
Like, right.
You know, it's like all our friends are friends. They all hang out and they go off and do these rad things. And
I mean, coming from skateboard culture in Los Angeles, I mean, Steve Caballero, that's like, you talk about like, to, you know, the Bones Brigade, Hawk,
oh, yeah.
You know, Mullen, Cab, Lance Mountain, you know, it's kind of like, you know, a top tier hierarchy of like, you know, like Zeppelin and the Who, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Cab is a big deal. I mean, he's just so pioneering in his skateboarding, and he changed things, you know? So, I mean, to be like, you know, connected with him on a level of like talking about his toy collection.
Right, right. And then on top of that, there's guys like, you know, Kenny Anderson, Chad Timtim, Eric Costin, Pat Shinita. It just goes on. Lincoln Ouida. It just goes on and on and on and on. You know, there's so many rad skaters that I've, you know, got to interview. And
Was there ever a time where you actually went to just like do an interview where like maybe a session was going on where they were skating?
Yeah, yeah. For Ray Barbie, for example, you know, I just went with him and my buddy who was shooting him. I just went out on a shoot with him, you know, and same with
street skating.
Yeah. And then Kian Liu also, we went to, it was me, him and Grant, Britain, you know,
from
San Diego. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I've actually got to go on like these skate shoots, you know, with the real deal, you know, like it wasn't just like going to Thai food or something.
Yeah. Well, where was the Ray Barbie street session at?
Oh man, that was like at some, I want to say some roots were pushing up a piece of sidewalk, and he was just like outside a Mexican food place. And, you know, he just like just did it over and over, and he was just jamming. And, you know, he's the coolest, nicest guy you'll ever meet. And he actually, he played my wedding, man.
I know, you were telling me about that. That's amazing.
Yeah, he and, you know, my buddies Ben and Happy, and I have friends who were in his band back then. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, how cool is that, right? To have Ray Barbie playing your wedding.
Yeah, totally. I mean, just to, you know, just to see him skate too is just so like pleasant, because he's like so smooth and, you know, just kind of like just kind of coast.
Yeah, and he's like that way in life. You know, he's just always smiling, and he's just the raddest dude.
Totally mellow.
Yeah. San Diego or Long Beach, man. He's the guy.
Exactly. Now, as far as some of your more memorable experiences with your interviews with bands, who were some of your favorite interviews that you personally put together and interviewed?
Oh, man. Like, you know, the thing about the magazine is it kind of gave me, I went from being like this geeked out fanboy to being a journalist. You know, I would go to these shows anyway, but because we had a magazine, I could contact them and get in and take pictures and interview them.
Sure.
You know, so I actually became friends with a lot of them. And, you know, J Church is probably, you know, my favorite band of all time.
Right.
Just because this dude, Lance Hahn, came from Hawaii. So he'll sing about Hawaii and, I don't know, spam masubi or whatever. But then he's totally DIY. So he'll sing about anarchy, and then he'll sing about Fei Wong, a Hong Kong movie star. So he was kind of like the ultimate giant robot guy, because he's DIY and he'd go from pop culture to politics, you know, on a dime.
Right.
And he's into everything, but he knew what he was good at. And man, he was like my hero.
That's great. What about some of the other band interviews?
Man, I'd have to say
Are there any favorites, personally?
Man, the Dillinger Four guys were cool. You know, I have to say, like, sometimes we wouldn't even interview people who are Asian. For example, you know, I think that Brujeria.
Right.
Know, yeah. I interviewed Pinche and, and you know, and it was in Alhambra.
The Kings of Satanic Hispanics.
Yeah. And, you know, like, so I went there and, you know, it was a total smoking out house, but they had a baby and they were talking
smoking
about.
Smoking out house.
Yeah. And they were planning.
Kind of, you know, like Cheech and Chong.
Yeah. So Fantasma awesome. Was there, who I knew from his previous bands. Yeah, him and Pinche were just talking about touring, but they had, you know, they're smoking, but then they had like a baby there, you know.
And they're smoking weed?
Maybe or something. But, you know, but Brujeria, you know, like, the thing is, you can't live on just chow fun and dumplings. You know, sometimes you want a taco, you know. So I think just because we're Asian popular culture, we never really, you know, we were able to break the rules now and then.
Right. I mean, it just seems so far and wide. The reach that was coming from the inside of the editorial office, it just seemed like you guys just had like a far reach of what you wanted to grasp and cover. And it also seemed like you guys were interested in a lot of things, not just Asian culture.
Oh man, it was so important that we're not just writing about Asian stuff for Asian people, because most Asian people are really lame and they don't care. You know, they don't care about cool culture. They like really crappy bands, like these pop bands, and they'll root for, I don't know, like these lame sitcoms, just like all other people. You know, most people like really crappy entertainment. And ultimately, you know, the people that like
to... I call them the sheep. Whoever likes crappy entertainment, it's the sheep of society.
Yeah, right? And they know it sucks, but they'll still sit down and watch it every night. And then they'll talk about how much it sucks the next day with their friends, and they'll all agree, and yet they still keep doing it. So I think Giant Robot is, you know, it was for people who were sick of that. And it doesn't matter if you're Asian or not. You know, it's just cool stuff.
Absolutely.
Coming from somewhere new or different.
Yeah, and as a customer of yours, you know, back in the 90s, I mean, someone who's really just excited about skateboarding and music, period, were the first two passions I had. Gravitating towards that magazine, it was like, oh, you know, I'm going to get both those things, but I'm also going to get cool content that they're into. Maybe it's the toys or the movies or see a very, very unconventional review of hot sauce tasted, you know, and the taste testing was done by Guar.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? Like, you could be really into music and skateboarding and you'll buy it, but then you'll discover, you know, some badass filmmaker,
right?
Maybe, right? Some, you know,
right? Or some rad pro skater you never heard of.
Yeah. You know? So that's the idea, is that, you know, you're always going to find something new and trip out on stuff. And it's not like you're going to pick it up just so you can feel like, oh, I know this guy, I know that guy, I'm an expert on this topic. No, you should always be turned on to something new.
Right. So, next question for you. At that time when the internet wasn't, you know, around and not used for, you know, to search out information at your fingertips, et cetera, what were some of the challenges? Now, I'm not talking whether it's financial, you know, or any kind of infrastructure with the company. I'm talking like, when you went out and had to connect with maybe other people in the publishing world, whether because you guys got to a level, you were in Tower and so forth, where it was, you know, you guys were maybe invited to do panels and at colleges, you guys are relevant. What were some of the challenges, if any? Maybe there's not. Was there ever challenges that came your way? Like people assumed you guys were certain people and you really weren't?
Yeah, every day, man, everything. And it came from both sides too.
Tell me.
Because on one hand, like the small, you know, the all the Asian American movement, you know, Yellow Power, these, you know, kids in college where they're just discovering their Asianness. And, you know, and they're got their red books and everything else and they feel oppressed.
Okay.
You know, they saw us as the sellouts. You know,
really?
They thought, yeah. They totally thought we were just merchandising Asian culture for hipsters before hipsters existed.
Right.
You know, like they totally thought we were sellouts. And then, but conversely, you know, like let's say Warner Brothers was bringing Jet Li over and I really wanted to interview him because to us, you know, he was the hero. You know, he was like, he was totally just kicking Whitey ass, you know, in his movies.
Right.
And so we wanted to have him and we're, you know, I was sending these long emails saying why, you know, our readers really want to have the first English interview with Jet Li. And, you know, then they offer us like this round table with 10 other college papers or something. And we're like, no, you know, you can't do that. And, you know, we just kept bugging them and bugging them. And then they acquiesced and sent him over to our office. And he spent like 2 hours
really,
you know, hanging out at our office. And he was like a really cool dude.
Let's back up really quick. So when you're talking about the, you know, the quote unquote, the oppressed Asian college student with the red books.
Yeah.
Now, are you telling me that you would be pointed out and, you know, and be told like, oh, you guys are just exploiting this culture?
Yeah. Like maybe they would think that, you know, we're just packaging the pretty parts or cool parts,
right?
You know, as a commodity, you know, or selling culture, or maybe
just the surface.
Yeah. And then other people would criticize us because we're dudes writing about dudes and how we're this, you know, all boy het fest, you know, how we're not, there's not enough women and we're not being sensitive enough to, you know, gay rights or, you know, or whatever. And like, we got a lot of heat for just being ourselves.
So was it a lot of like hate mail maybe, or just opinions?
No, I think it's all just back, you know, talking behind our backs and discussion boards and stuff more than people saying that we suck, you know, to our faces. That, you know, there were no knives to the face, as Mike Vallely said. You know, it was more the knife to the back thing.
Right.
But there were Ginsu knives, you know, because we're Asian.
So you got what you wanted from, you know, Warner Brothers with Jet Li.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah,
he came to the office.
Yeah, and he was badass. He's small. I like towered over him.
How tall is he?
He's like my shoulder height, you know, like.
Is he really that big? He's like 4 feet?
No, he probably cracks 5, but man, he was fast and he was cool. He was like the coolest dude.
Did he demo martial arts in front of you?
A little bit. You know, our photographer was like, dude, you got to do something, you know, and he whipped out a couple, but he was rad, you know, he's like a humanitarian and, you know, he's like a rad dude.
So he's a super good dude then.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's awesome.
You know, I don't think we met anyone who was a real dick. Like we met people who were bad interviews maybe.
Right.
You know, like I remember the corner shop guy, he's a genius. But man, he was a lousy interview. And same with like Cornelius, another genius. Lousy interview.
Nothing to say, and really.
Anna Tsuchiya, that she was in a couple like, I don't know, she was this pop star who was in like these arty Japanese movie. Crappy interview. But it was very, but all of them were nice. You know, I've never met a jerk. They were all just, some were just bad interviews, you know?
Gotcha. So we're going to take a break. We're going to play some tunes from Martin Wong, A Giant Robot's personal playlist. Some of the bands that he actually covered in, you know, on Giant Robot. And when we come back, we'll tell you what we played. So hang tight and go for it, Martin. It's all you.
All right. Here's Jay Church.
Cool.
Sailward, old folks act like they hadn't heard. Judy went to
Listening to Los Angelesnista. I'm Edward Solis, and my in-studio guest tonight, Martin Wong from Giant Robot. Martin, I got to tell you, thank you for coming in tonight.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And doing episode 11.
Oh, man, just to get to play J Church and Cringer on any sort of station, like, I'm stoked to do that.
That's rad. Yeah, you know, I just want to thank you personally for being a part of this incredible month of February here at Los Angeles Anista and Skid Row Studios. Completing the rest of the month after you, we got Fred Ortiz, you know, Beastie Boys, Bongaloids musician, and we also have Ed Culver coming in.
He's a stud. I have his book, The Blight at the End of the Tunnel. It's so good.
You dig it?
Yeah, it's that guy's a legend.
Yeah, I mean, he's an icon, you know.
Did you get that Black Flag zine, that the scam issue?
I did not yet.
They talk about the filming or the photography for the cover, you know, with Henry punching the mirror.
Right.
And they tell the, is it okay if I blow a secret for you? Or do you, yeah, you know the history already.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, they actually tell the concoction of blood to make it look real, his punching of the mirror and how they shot it, the lighting and everything. And it's a really amazing zine that everyone should pick up. I got mine at Vacation.
Yeah, yeah. And we're going to be talking about Vacation as we get into the second hour of Los Angeles Nista.
Oh, I'm sorry to jump ahead.
No worries. Well, so, and then on the 25th of February, we got James Rhoda, producer of the new Dave Grohl film, Sound City.
Dude, you went to that show at the Palladium, huh?
Last Thursday was amazing.
I saw your picture on Instagram. That's heavy.
Yeah, Rick Springfield, to me, that was the best.
With the Foo Fighters backing him up.
No, it was serious power pop. It was like DGC era, like, you know, power pop going down.
Yeah, I just thought of something. Did you put me on? You know, I can see why all the Black Flag dudes are on, because, like, you timed it perfectly. Did you put me on because of Chinese New Year next weekend? Is that?
I had no idea it was Chinese New Year.
Oh, well, Gung Hei Fat Choi to you and everyone else. Happy Year of the Snake, dudes.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Okay, so let's get into it. So we're back here with Martin Wong of Giant Robot. Welcome, everyone, to Los Angeles Nista. We're taking calls, 800-893-9562, and we're going to be getting into the second hour soon, but I wanted to go deep into the Giant Robot infrastructure. You know, when you guys were, you know, right in the middle of it all, you guys did 16 issues, right? No, I'm sorry, 60.
68.
68, issues. That's it. Sorry for the fact checking.
16 years.
16 years, that's it. I mean, as you guys were, you know, really on a roll of getting these magazines out and widely distributed worldwide, you know, me as a customer, looking from the outside, looking in, seeing full color and glossy and big, and you're buying it from the Tower Records, you know, a shelf. Was it really a big operation, or was it total DIY? Rock?
It was totally DIY. We were in the garage. You know, it was a nice garage with carpet and DirecTV, and we had NBA channel. But
would you watch basketball?
Oh, dude, we're such huge Laker fans. You don't even know. We love the Lakers.
Awesome.
I mean, literally, like, I was the only full-time employee. After the magazine, after the stores opened on Sawtelle, I was able to stop my McGraw-Hill gig, and then I worked on the magazine full time, and it was just me. Eric would jump in, you know, towards the end of the cycle when he'd figure out, like, oh, you know, I think I want to do this article and that article. And then later on, you know, Wendy would come in and do layout. Pryor would do color balancing, and our ad person would be cranking the whole time. And that's it. Like, we didn't have, you know, there was no production assistant or assistant editors or any of that stuff. All the mistakes are my fault.
You take full accountability.
All my fault. But, okay, you know, at the same time, I take credit for making a lot of inarticulate people sound really smart and great.
Yeah, that takes a lot of work.
You know, and sometimes it's because they're Asian, you know, maybe they're fobs or, you know, whatever. But I worked really hard on making a voice and making everyone, because we were fans of everyone. You know, we did not put people in the magazine if they were lame. Like, everyone, we were fans of everything. It's so easy to put in, you know, a crummy interview with someone who sucks and make fun of them or whatever. But no, we were huge proponents. Like, we were on a soapbox just sharing the most rad culture ever.
That's amazing. You know, what about the extension of Giant Robot? I remember you guys had a gallery show at the Japanese museum downtown?
Yeah, you're thinking of the Biennale, which Eric, you know, he's, you know, pretty good friends with the museum, and they want, you know, a younger, cooler crowd, of course, not necessarily Japanese, and Giant Robot was like the perfect venue. So Eric curated these huge art shows, and they're really cool, you know, like I think Janum needs it, because you can only show old luggage so often, you know, so much before people burn out on the internment camps and this really important stuff, but they need new blood coming through. And that's where Giant Robot comes through. And Eric was awesome. Like, he just steps up his game every single time. Like this last time, you know, you just walk into the art. It's no longer just art on the walls, but it's really conceptual. And, you know, you walk into it, it's laid out brilliantly. And I was totally psyched for him.
That's
but,
amazing.
At the same time, you know, it's still a very small office, you know, and it was, you know, when I was there for sure. Like I remember I was called in for jury duty and, you know, Lance Ito was the judge. He was the judge. Yeah. He was. And this.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, everyone's lining up and saying, oh man, I want to get out of it because of this. Or, you know, I walked up, it was my turn. I said, you know, I work in a really small magazine office and, you know, there's two of us and we're in a garage.
So this is you talking to him direct.
Yeah. I was talking to Lance Ito and he said, you know, HP started in a garage. And I said, yeah, but we're still in the garage. Like, if I'm not there, the magazine's not going to happen. And at the same time, in the back of my head, I'm like, oh crap, you know, right down the block, there's this big giant robot banner outside Janum. And
the museum
if he puts
building.
Two and two together, you know, he would think that giant robot is this huge entity, you know, with big museum size banners or, you know,
right.
billboards. But luckily he's, you know, he must be kind of out of touch with his Asian-ness or something.
Is that safe to say?
Yeah, he had no idea what I was talking about or he didn't connect them. So I was pretty relieved afterwards.
So did you get off the hook?
Oh yeah, totally. Although I love jury duty. Let's backtrack. You know, I think, you know, I've been a foreman and stuff and got us out of there in 2 days and I'm really proud of that. But man, I can't be there for 2 weeks and we had a magazine to make.
So this was after the big Ito case, right?
Oh yeah. I wouldn't have known who he was otherwise.
Right. So he was a celebrity.
Oh, totally. Yeah. It was pretty crazy. He was probably the most, you know, famous Asian person in LA, you know, versus all these hack actors or filmmakers or whatever.
So what year was this?
Oh man, that must've been, gosh, around the first Biennale. So 7 years ago, maybe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He was, you know, there were still dancing Itos in people's memory back then.
tell us about the giant robot store.
Oh, so Eric actually, you know, we were working in the backyard of his Sawtelle house that we moved to eventually. And then the spot opened, you know, on Sawtelle. And, you know, it's a spot where it wasn't like now, where it's like super hopping and there's boba shops and noodle shops and, you know, it's totally pan-Asian.
So back then it was a lot less foot traffic less cooler.
No, it was like bonsai and wooden slippers. You know, it was an origami paper. It was so uncool. I mean, there were some things that were still there, like Hurry Curry or, you know, Safe and Save Market was there with all the cool candy and stuff, but it was not cool in any way. You know, it was like really dead. And in fact, there was actually, I remember Eric, he booked a Flag Camp Jawbreaker show, like right around the corner in this dirt lot. And now there's like big condos there. So
what year was that?
That show?
Yeah.
Oh, that must have been early 90s.
And
probably.
So how big was the venue like?
Oh, it was a dirt lot. It was like the back of a house.
It was like a backyard show.
Yeah, I remember I think they played El's Bar like the night after or something like that.
Wow. So how many shows went down there?
That's the only one I went to.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the West Side sucks for music. You know that?
Yeah,
it's always
really bad.
I mean, I'm not going to say it always sucked because I saw some pretty rad shows. What was it, like FM Station or something?
Oh,
I can't
my
remember
God.
What it was called.
That was like the worst. That was like where all like the glam metal.
Yeah, but I remember I saw a benefit with X and the Chili Peppers there, you know, like in this really small place when I was in college. So,
sure.
Yeah. And you know, UCLA, like, man, they had SST bands every Friday, like this feast. Like in the late, so I saw all these bands like Swa and
when
Gone.
When you went to UCLA, what your frame time?
So
frame
that was between 86 and 90. So that's like totally ancient history, but it was rad history. Like I do not mind being old when it comes to shows, you know?
And what was the name of the venue?
It was just the Cooperage at UCLA. Yeah. You know, I saw the Rollins band play like a really early show there. Jane's Addiction before their studio album came out.
Wow.
I remember Seaweed. I remember seeing Tribe Called Quest there. You know, I have a bootleg of Jawbreaker there. There was a Chemical People All show, like a Food Edge show was there. I saw so many, like, oh, Heavenly played there. No, it wasn't Heavenly. Anyway, my buddies, Craig and Lynn and all these other, you know, they were Campus Events and they were awesome.
That's amazing. I was curious if that venue is still going.
Yeah, I think just music isn't the same. You know, I remember seeing Public Enemy, like on the Nation of Millions, I think, you know, like outside in the coop, you know?
Yeah. I remember hearing the name and seeing the flyers or, you know, with that name. And obviously I really, you know, I wouldn't go to UCLA for shows back then. I was much younger, but, I mean, all these bands that you're naming off are just so epic and are really, not aside from being established and successful, these bands were very pioneering.
Yeah. And I think it really informed Giant Robot, you know, in a way, like all of this craziness, you know, like
it was it an inspiration?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, all these do-it-yourself bands, like that's what drove Giant Robot, not necessarily cinema or fashion or politics, but it all came from music. That's where the energy came from, all the punk rockness, you know?
Right. Tell us about the Giant Robot blog that's up right now, the website.
Well, you know, I guess since the magazine stopped publishing a couple of Novembers ago, the outlet is the blog. And, you know, a lot of it is, you know, Eric blogs and Michelle does. And, you know, I try to do it at least once a week. But mostly I just write about my friends who do cool stuff, like you. For example.
So is this something where, I mean, obviously it's very active. Who besides you, so there's two other writers?
At least. Yeah. I mean, there's a couple other dudes, you know,
right.
I think there's contributors. It's different, you know, like I think the web is just all about getting stuff up faster before everyone else and just sending a link and, you know, I don't know. I enjoy it. I like, it gives me an excuse.
It's fun and it's very active.
Yeah. I get to practice for, you know, like my hobby is taking pictures of bands at shows. You know, I get to have an outlet for it. I don't, you know, I kind of have an excuse to be that annoying guy in front with a camera, you know,
and you're not annoying.
Sometimes I don't use flash, so I'm not that annoying. As bad as other people.
You take great photos, by
the
way.
The worst is when you see people in front and they have flash and they're just ruining it for everyone else. They don't know how to take a picture. And you can kind of see in the back of the camera, like this person is just taking pictures of the backs of people's heads. And like, what are you doing? Like you kind of want to tell them how to take a picture and, but maybe it's an Asian thing. Like all of us Asian people are photographers, you know, I don't know.
Do you think that's true?
Oh yeah, man. If you're ever like going somewhere and you want someone to take a picture of you, ask the Asian person for sure. Like just the odds, you know, the odds are in your favor.
It's in the DNA.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know what it is, you know? Yeah.
So what do you think or what's the reality of Giant Robot doing any more physical releases?
I don't know, man. I heard like Eric has alluded to it, you know, on his blog once or twice. And I'm like, wow, that's cool. But as for me, man, I'm like I had this life when, you know, when I would work, you know, 80 hours a week or whatever and just, you know, live off what my wife made and stuff like that. And she was actually the designer for Giant Robot.
Oh, so, was she?
Yeah. So she understood my passions and she knew.
Okay. So she was a part of the team.
Yeah. And conversely, I was her production assistant. So I prepared all the layouts. I imported everything. I prepared all the images. And so I knew that I was able to take direction from her.
Like a good husband.
So that meant I could be her husband. Yeah.
Right.
But,
so that was like the training ground for husbandry.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I got, that was another, you know, I made so many great friends. I met so many rad
sure.
people and I met my wife, you know? So, but I guess what I'm getting back to is that even if like the magazine happened again, I don't know if I could do that again, man. Like now I'm a husband and dad and I try to be a really awesome one. And, you know, I'm afforded that now.
Right. And so, I mean, so Eric alluded to it. So, I mean, do you think there would maybe be like maybe just like an annual issue? Is there any talk at all? I mean, that's pretty exciting.
Not with me. You got to ask him.
Oh, gotcha.
You
gotcha.
Know, I don't know. Like, you know, it's weird. Like he's like my best buddy and I called him up, you know, and then for very important, you know, personal things, but you know, we just don't talk about business that much. It's, you know, I guess.
You kind of moved on. Well, it seems like, you know, Giant Robot for you, your personal experience, you know, with the energy that the magazine conveyed outward, it made a lot of people happy.
You know what's funny though? I was thinking of that last Biennale actually. And you know, the place where I work now, it's this really forward thinking, Asian focused advertising company. Awesome. Totally visionary. I'm down with it. So my boss actually set us up to all go to the Giant Robot Biennale, you know, because she's into cool stuff and she likes Eric, and that's how she met me, of course. And, you know, so we're in the art show and I'm like looking at this little piece and some dude's looking at, admiring a piece in it. You know, I just chipped in because I knew. I said, yeah, you know, I like this piece a lot. It's by Luke Chu, who actually did the cover for the very last physical issue of Giant Robot. And look, I love how he made the magazine and he replicated the layout inside and all the way to the back cover, man. Like, that is awesome. This guy is a contributor, but he's a fan, you know? And then this dude just looked at me and said, oh, you're a pretty big fan, huh? And then I just like, I had nothing to say. I'm like, yeah, I guess so. I'm a big fan.
Well, that's pretty amazing. Like, as far as like, it was very linear, you know? I mean, your excitement and passion for it without him knowing who you were.
Yeah, but I've always been like kind of behind the scenes though. You know, like I never was the face of the mags. I never wanted to be, but you know, so, you know, I wasn't used to it, but it was just weird. You know, that moment was really awkward for me. It was different.
It seems at that time too, I mean, you guys were dealing with a lot of like, you know, bands and, you know, at the time the music industry had a lot more excessive dollars to spend. So would you guys get invited to all these like, you know, really like generous kind of like gatherings and stuff like that?
We never got wined and dined by music, but I think it's interesting that a lot of our early advertisers were labels like Epitaph and Fat, and, you know, they were like big supporters of Giant Robot, and it wasn't ever like Asian companies that supported us. Or
yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Yeah, so a lot of the ad dollars were not from Asian companies.
Yeah, which was crazy. You'd think that they'd be all supporting us or down with the cause or whatever, but no, it was always like the punk rock, you know, labels or Hookups, right? The skateboard company had the back. They had it in lockdown. Which is really cool.
They bought like the whole year or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, Jeremy Klein and Tony Hawk were, you know, paying a significant amount of our printing bill, which was rad. And we'd always have Ming Tran, you know, kicking Jeremy's ass on the back cover.
Right.
You know, what's cool is that she actually got back in touch with me kind of recently.
Oh, really?
She's like an airline pilot now.
What?
And she happened to be going to Comic-Con and she texted me, "I'm going to Comic-Con." I said, "I'm here." And I hung out with her for like 4 days straight because her boyfriend was busy and couldn't go.
Okay.
So it was so rad. I was like, whoa, I'm hanging out with Ming Tran trying to be like a friend and not dork out. You know,
that's pretty cool.
But she's like the biggest Trekkie. You know, she's like really into Star Trek. So
she was in like total. Yeah,
don't
like,
tell anyone, but she is.
And Star Trek heaven.
Yeah, yeah. She was really, you know, I took her to like the Love and Rockets panel with Los Bros Hernandez, you know, like the comic. Yeah, and she was like tripping out on that. And I just took her to all the stuff that I was into. And she was like totally into it, you know, which was rad.
That's awesome. What about, you know, some of your, you know, being Asian, do you like a lot of Asian food?
Oh.
Or do you like all food?
I like all food, but I eat a lot of Asian food, you know, for sure. Yeah, it's the best in LA, especially because I think Asian food is the one thing where you can have it any hour of the day, first of all, because they're all open super late. You know, people say how there's nothing open late at night, but go to Thai Town, Koreatown,
yeah,
you know, San Gabriel Valley.
Turung is open till 3:30 in the morning.
Right. And that place is awesome. So first of all, you're not bound by hours. Secondly, I think price does not necessarily correspond with quality.
Right.
You know, like if you're going to go get a steak, I don't even eat meat, but if you buy a steak, you have to spend a lot of money to get a good one. Well, I think if it's like Chinese noodles or something, like there are some of the cheapest, dirtiest, nastiest places that have the best food. So just think about it. You know, hours, you know, you're not limited by hours or money, you know, and you can get the raddest food from like these crazy regions in Asia, like the most precise thing. Like, you know, there'll be these places that specializes in, you know, cow testicle juice exploding noodles or whatever. You know, like you can find super precise stuff these days that you can't even find in most of Asia.
So we're going to wrap up this first hour of Los Angeles Nista with our in-studio guest, Martin Wong, Giant Robot. We're going to take a break. We're going to play a few tunes from Martin's personal playlist. And we're going to come back and get into classic Los Angeles Nista format. And we're going to talk Silver Lake. That is Martin's city of choice. I'm going to tell everyone how to get there by public transportation and not contribute to the gas companies. So who are we going to listen to?
We're going to listen to some Chinese Jamaican producers.
All right.
Yeah, check it out. I was really proud of these interviews.
Let's do it.
To call.
Welcome back to Los Angeles, NISTEM. Your host, Edward Solis. My in-studio guest, Martin Wong from Giant Robot. Tell us who we're listening to, Martin.
Oh, that was the Romaines.
From Japan?
Yeah, yeah. It's a three-piece girl band that just does Ramon songs. But they totally, they're super raw and gnarly. I like it. They make each song their own. And then before that was this dude, Dirty Beaches.
Okay.
And he's like, he looks like an Asian Fonz, but he totally rips. Like, that song is the gateway song that gets people into him because it's all pretty and stuff. But man, he rips live. And I got to give a shout out to Sandy Vu from the Dum Dum Girls, actually.
Great.
Introduced me to his music and him. And she rules too. Like, Dum Dums are rad, but so is Sisu, her psychedelic jam band that I think is opening for Cat Power now. So she's like totally ripping. And yeah, before that was the Chinese Jamaican, you know, Santik and Clive Chin. And yeah, I interviewed all these music producers from Jamaica who are of Chinese ancestry.
Okay.
So they look Chinese, but then like, yeah, man, I made the first dub record, you know? And like, wow. These guys, they get the first Augustus Pablo or the first dub plate. Yeah, it's rad. So I was really proud of those articles.
Very cool, man. We got a caller. Let's take that call.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you? Hey, Martin, how you doing? Eddie, how you doing?
How are you?
Is this Tad?
Yeah, this is Tadashi.
Dude, Tadashi he's a really important dude. I'm glad he called because he kind of got me started on this. You know that skateboard film festival that I was telling you about, Eddie?
Yeah.
Okay, so this dude, he Tadashi, my good friend, he put together this rad skate short called The Working Man. It's like shot on red in downtown L.A. You would dig it because it's like a love letter to Los Angeles.
Okay.
But he just shreds and he's wearing a suit the whole time. Way before the new, yeah, that other video with suits.
So it's a documentary on skateboard.
Yeah, another one.
Yeah, it's like a short. But basically it didn't make it into a local film festival. And I was so pissed off that I started sending it to my friends who do film festivals. And my friend said, yeah, that's great. You know, I sent him a link. So this is a rad skate short. We want to show up, but you got to put together a whole program to go with it. So what I did was, you know, I had some other friends that had skate videos that were not getting circulated. And I put together this package of skate videos, and it showed in what? Tadashi, where did, like, Chicago?
Chicago, San Diego, Hawaii.
Oh, yeah, Honolulu,
Hawaii,
man.
Hawaii.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, and we all went. We went together. Like, we stayed in houses together and hung out together, and they all played with my daughter together. And
it was awesome.
You know, and
it was such a great experience, and it was awesome to actually be in Hawaii and have you there too, Martin, and just be a part of that whole experience is rad.
Yeah, because I don't get to share culture like I used to love sharing the rad stuff that people do, and you actually gave me the outlook or the chance to share something new and cool, and I really appreciate that. You and T are the best.
What was the name of the doc again?
His is called The Working Man, but then he made a follow-up called Perfect Timing or The Perfect Time, and I'm actually in it for a second. So.
Oh, awesome. So, okay.
Yeah, Martin's in it, ripping on it. It's so awesome to see Martin skating because I don't know if many people know that, but Martin, you actually skate really well and you rip. So
awesome.
It's so cool to have you like in the short as well doing that.
It's heavy though because it's like just a short that you put together for fun, and then you have Salman Aga in it.
Salman Aga's in it?
Dude, and then you have Frank Fiction from The Far Side doing music, and it's like this all-star thing just for like this fun little project. It's super cool.
So how can people get this or see it?
We don't actually have the full-length film online yet, but you can see a trailer for it at theworkingmanmovie.com.
Okay, great.
And that also, after you play the trailer, it gives you a link to the shorter version of Perfect Time, which is called Perfect Timing, which was, you know, the one that Frank Friction scored and the one that Salman, the one we just spoke about. But yeah, you can see that film as well.
Yeah, and you know what I love about what you're doing is that, you know, like instead of sending demos or tape, you know, sponsor me tapes, like, you know, kind of like bands used to do for labels, but now they just do it themselves.
Sure.
You know, this is a skater who's just doing it himself. Like, you know, instead of going through the hoops and trying to get connected and broing down with the right people, he's just making his own. And they rule, and I'm, you know, so I'm really stoked that I get to help get them shown. Actually, we're going to show in New York this summer.
Oh, that's awesome.
Which is going to be rad.
So The Working Man is basically someone's passion project.
Exactly.
Yes.
And you skate, totally. And you're making your own video, and you're reaching out to people that you want in your video, and it's as simple as that.
Correct.
That's pretty killer.
Yeah, and just like, you know, I love downtown L.A. too, and part of the thing was, for The Working Man, was just skateboarding in downtown L.A. in my suit. and getting away with it, because, you know, downtown LA is strictly prohibited, and especially during the weekday. But that's when we went and filmed.
Oh,
which
wow.
was great, because it was during the weekday in my suit.
Did you get chased out?
Other people who are in their suits. And I totally blended in. And if anything, honestly, I had a run in with the police, and they actually let me skate the actual spot longer because I was in a suit.
So it's kind of like a psychological thing for the police, right?
For sure. I don't know. It actually worked out on my behalf. So I was really excited to see. I don't know. It's almost like I got treated with more respect because I was in a suit. But I'm like, I'm still skateboarding, you know? it's so funny.
It doesn't hurt.
It doesn't hurt that you're a good-looking dude.
Oh, thank you, Martin. Thank you.
So let me ask you a question. Did you skate those epic brick banks? You know the ones,
Macy's Banks.
Yeah.
I don't have any tricks. I do skate through the Macy's Banks, but I didn't do any tricks or anything
right.
on them.
Those transitions.
I mean, fast. I mean, I skated the Los Angeles Library, the LA Metro spots. Like, I mean, everything throughout downtown. It was awesome.
I remember watching Eric Dressen, his parts in all the Santa Cruz Speed Wheels video. Risk It and Speed Freaks, and he's just tearing mm-hmm. up those brick banks. You know, and like there's a bunch of them, and they're all like four sides, right? And a really fast transition with a tight hip. Really, really just insane. But I think now it's like people see, like you said, like if you go during business hours, 9 to 5, during the weekday, you're going to be the target.
For sure, right away. Obviously, yeah.
Yeah, you know, Eddie, you would appreciate this. Tadashi is actually part of my Bronson ditch crew.
Oh.
Yeah, so we've been going, we went on Thanksgiving morning. We went on 4th of July morning. So the next holiday, you got to go too. You know, when Tadashi.
Yeah, and then, seriously, it's been so much fun.
Yeah, and John Lee from SGV and Winco, the world famous, skate film dude.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I've been hitting every other Sunday. I've been trying to hit Carruthers Skate Park in Bellflower. 6 foot ball.
Right. Oh, dude, I saw the pictures of you. You grind.
Frontside grinds.
Yeah,
dude,
those are sweet.
It.
No pads necessary. You're up there, man.
Yeah, whatever happens, happens.
Super psyched to see those. Those Insta pictures are gold.
Yeah.
And nice.
Yeah,
nice.
Pretty fun. But So Tadashi, is there anything else you want to plug? I mean, is there a follow up that you have?
Yes, I'm actually working on some other stuff right now, but I'm just keeping that on the low for right now. I don't really want to talk about it, but yeah, definitely some other stuff I'm working on, and you can follow me on Instagram at The Working Man.
Okay, and give the website again for your doc.
It is theworkingmanmovie.com.
Okay, great. Thanks for calling.
All right, thanks, man.
Thank you so much, Eddie. Nice to talk to you, Martin, and it's been a pleasure. Thank you, gentlemen.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
All right,
take care. Bye.
Oh, that was a cool surprise.
That's cool. It was a pleasure to meet one of your friends here live on the air. So let's get into the Los Angeles Nista format. So Martin picks Silver Lake. Okay. Now, what I find interesting about this dynamic here is Martin is from Orange County. He's not a transplant from out of state. Okay. So you moved into Silver Lake in what year?
Oh, man. Well, after I graduated from college in 90, I moved to Los Feliz.
Okay.
And then I worked at McGraw-Hill and I saved money. And then I wanted to, I couldn't afford Los Feliz. So I moved to Silver Lake. I bought a house actually in 97 or 98 when it was still affordable.
Right.
And man, everything has changed since then. Like it's so different.
When it was still gangster.
I don't know.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah. I don't, it was when the restaurants weren't as nice, I guess. But I live really close to the reservoir and, so people used to get run over there all the time because that was before they had the nice walkway.
Right.
And there was this dirt lot on my corner, right by Rockaway Records. And now it's a beautiful library, that's all modernist design.
Right. So you moved into Silver Lake pre-internet and pre-hipster.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was, and it was awesome. We used to, so many bands stayed at my house there. It was really close to Spaceland, so.
Yeah. So, okay, so what I want to do is paint a picture for people. When you moved in to now, tell us what is different about it?
Well, first of all, there's that, I it's a lot nicer. It used to be, a lot of people would get run over. I think more people were held up in my neighborhood and stuff.
Okay.
And now it's, it's kind of, I guess you could say it's gentrified. But man, right. As a parent with a 4-year-old, to have that walkway and the meadow that were not there before. You know, people were all up in arms. No meadow, you know, free the meadow or whatever. But man, it's the greatest thing. Like I drive past the walkway in the meadow, like at dusk, and I feel like I'm living in some resort or something. You know, it's like crowded, tons of people walking outside, families and, you know, sure, some are hipsters probably, whatever. But they should have a nice, healthy life outside too, man. It's California.
Yeah, safe and healthy, right?
Yeah, dude, I feel like I'm living in, you know, a postcard or something. It's so beautiful and rad. And then, you know, the library is right there. Like, I don't have cable or anything, but I borrow, you know, DVDs from the library all the time.
So you still go to the library and borrow DVDs?
Oh, totally, yeah.
I love it.
It's the best.
I love it. So let's get into the skateboarding. What's your skate spot by choice?
Oh, Bronson, for
okay,
sure.
The Bronson Ditch. Okay, and what movies have they filmed there?
Oh, Thrashing.
The classic skate movie, Thrashing.
There was that big duel, right?
Yeah.
And actually, you know, once I remember skating there with my buddy Mike Willard, who went on to become like a American Studies professor in Pomona. But we'd go there all the time. And, you know, he was definitely better. He could ollie in and stuff. And I was just, you know, kind of a surf style slashing.
Right.
But I could go all the way down from the top to bottom, you know. But once we were there and this dude was just ripping, he was so good. And then at the end, he was like, oh man, you know, good skating with you. By the way, my name's TA. You could buy my stuff, you know.
Tony Alva?
Yeah, it was Tony Alva. I couldn't believe it.
How long? He was just there by himself?
Yeah, and he was just, you know, super nice to us and so cool. And then once we took him, I took Kian Liu there once. And, you know, I've Johnny Fonseca was skating with Wing once. You know so I've skated with
How long ago did you see TA there?
Oh, that must have been, oh man. Before Giant Robot, maybe, you know, that long, yeah, like 20 years ago.
So, Alva days.
Yeah, I was going there like once a week though for a while.
Okay. So as far as, you know, being a Silver Lake resident, you would say like the Bronson Ditch is like the closest thing that you have available to skate that is pretty skatable.
Well, for me as a guy who doesn't, you know, I'm not good at street or anything. Like I got my first skateboard when I was a student at UCLA and didn't have a car. So my buddy said, okay, we got to go to Rip City. You're going to get I remember I got a Santa Monica Airlines Choreo. No. I had a Steve Stedham first that I bought used. And then I got I want to say it was like a Stedham. Oh, had the Stedham and then Corey O'Brien, the Death's Head one.
Well, with the flame?
Yeah. I got
the flame
that.
Ball?
Yeah, and some OJ2s. And like, that was my transportation.
You were set.
Yeah, I remember skating. My friend and I, we took the bus from UCLA to Tower Records to see David Lee Roth climb up the fake mountain.
Dude, on the Skyscraper album. Yeah. I remember that.
Yeah, we took the bus with our skateboards.
So you got on the number 2 or 3 and took it from UCLA all the way to Tower on Sunset.
Yeah. And then the bus.
To see David Lee Roth climb a fake wall. Because his record was called Skyscraper.
Yeah. And,
that's,
you know,
so heavy.
Yeah. And it was, you know, there were like girls wearing bikinis standing on the side waving. And
yeah, for
freezing.
No reason. Just because
it was
Dave.
Diamond Dave. Because it could.
And you were stoked.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, I wasn't even like the biggest Van Halen fan. Like honestly, I went from Dr. Demento to Rodney on the Rock and I totally skipped metal and I kind of came back.
Right.
You know, after listening to Godhead Silo and fucking Champs and bands like that.
Right.
So, you know, I wasn't there the first time. But yeah, I just went just because it was him. You know, I respected him so much.
Through Van Halen and all that, yeah.
And then I know he has this whole backstory of being an art gallery owner and supporting all these punks. And, you know, Thelonious Bob worked there. And he has all these, you know, like he has this huge punk rock history too.
Yeah, he's got some pretty do-it-yourself ethos. And Dave is very supportive of like local artists and respects, has a good attitude.
Yeah, you know, I took the bus a lot from UCLA to shows. I remember going to the Palladium to see the Beastie Boys on the License to Ill tour with Murphy's Law and Fishbone.
Murphy's Law opened for the Beastie Boys.
Yeah, and that was the show with like the Go-Go Girls and the inflatable penis and all that.
Yep.
Yeah, and we took the bus there. And I remember going to the Whiskey to see Guns N' Roses and Johnny Thunders and all these bands. And like, I remember having to walk back from the Whiskey back to the dorms at UCLA.
You walked from the Whiskey to UCLA?
The buses stopped, yeah. And I remember like...
Okay, let me interject really quick. The line 2 and 3, well, there's no more line 3, but the line 2 is now 24 hours.
Okay, was like...
So
know,
now
the,
you can go see Guns N' Roses at the Whiskey and not walk back to the dorm.
This must have been 88 or something, you know, around then. And I remember the cops, like two sets of, not one car, but two cops pulled over and asked us what we were doing, you know, to make sure we weren't, I don't know, taking people's TVs. And we just said, oh, you know, we're going back to the dorms. And they said, okay, you know. So I guess I felt safe, you know, that they were looking out for us. But
right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, being at UCLA, pretty much that, you know, West Hollywood was like an ideal destination to see bands.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't too far.
No,
I mean,
no.
It was far to walk, definitely. But It wasn't like, you know, going all the way to Silver Lake.
Oh, no, no. Well, plus that's where shows were at, the Whiskey and the Roxy.
They still
then.
Are, right?
You I know, mean, not really. I think I love that Off and Red Cross had their record release shows on the Sunset Strip right. just to try to reestablish that connection.
Those classic venues.
Yeah, right. I think there should be a connection between the Doors and, you know, Jefferson Airplane or whatever and, you know, Off today or whoever. Sure. You know, like, and think of all the rad punk shows that happened at the Whiskey and Roxy. And, you know, I remember seeing Sonic Youth and, you know, all those, you know, the first Jesus and Mary Chain show at the Roxy. And there's so many rad shows. When the Descendants got back together, right? And they played five nights in a row.
Yeah.
I went to like four of them.
When they did Everything Sucks.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, the Sunset Strip, and then the SST Superstore was there.
You know what? I remember going to the SST Superstore in the 90s. I want to say it was like, what, 90, 91?
Yeah, around then.
Yeah. I remember like just being so stoked that like there was a record store devoted to this label only. And, you know, I would take the bus from Whittier to West Hollywood. I would get a ride from my parents and I would get dropped off at Orenday and Telegraph in Santa Fe Springs. And I would take the 462 all the way to downtown. And I would just get like pretty much like in the area where like the down and out is. And I would just walk across the street and get either the 2 or the 3 and take it in a straight shot all the way to down, you know, to West Hollywood, because it was right by the Whiskey. And I remember, like, you know, just going in there and, you know, I didn't have much money, so I'd buy like 1 7-inch at a time. But the experience, and then like one time Pat Smear used to work there.
Whoa.
And I bought a Chemical People 7-inch.
The one with the Cheap Trick?
Getaway.
Yeah.
Oh, Kiss.
Yeah, with the big drill car.
Yeah.
The other side. Yeah,
the split 7-inch, a big drill car. Yeah. And
Kiss and Cheap Trick.
Yeah. Big drill car did Cheap Trick. And Chemical People to get away from Kiss, which is off the Dress to Kill record. So I was like, oh, I don't have this. And then, like, you know, he gave me, like, it was Pat Smear. He sold it to me. And then he put so many, do you remember those stickers that said, fuck parental advice, SST records?
Yeah, and then there was, like, the corporate rock still sucks.
Yeah. All that. Like, he gave me a huge brick of stickers, and I was like, it made my day. I knew who he was at the time. I knew that was Pat from the Germs, and I didn't ask him or, you know, I was kind of like, I wasn't really starstruck. I was just excited that he was selling me records. And it was pretty amazing, like, how he went on to see, you know, do Nirvana and then the Foo Fighters.
And, you know, there was, I want to say in 90 or so, there was a time when I would see the Chemical People all in Big Drill Car, like 2 of the 3 bands every single weekend at the Anti-Club.
I remember
And
that.
I actually became, you know, pretty decent friends with Jaime Pena, you know, the punk rock Vato, and Dave Naz. You know, I'm still in touch with both of them.
Chemical People are great.
Oh, they were so... Yeah, totally buried. No one even appreciates how rad they were. Like, so, they were a jam band, man.
They could
play hard and heavy and, you know.
Jaime Pena is such a great guitarist. It's not even funny. That guy is just such a great musician.
Yeah, you know, I wanted him to play that show at Alex's with us, but he has some health problems now. So everyone's got to reach out to Jamie. You know?
Yeah, definitely. So would you say when you were going to school at UCLA and you had, you know, you were there in a dorm... You were coming from Orange County. Did you, when you immersed yourself in LA culture, right when you started school and got used to the LA vibe, did you really like say, yeah, this is where I belong?
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, I remember going to one of the first, maybe it was one of the last LA street scene. Do you remember that?
Oh, no. Dude, before my time.
Yeah. So I remember going downtown and seeing like Fire Hoses, second show, you know, and Psycom, I think, which is the band that became Jane's Addiction later on, you know.
Okay.
Like I saw all these bands for free
what
downtown.
What year was that?
That must have been 86 or 7.
Wow. Yeah. See, I was 11 or 12 at the time.
Dude, it was so, you don't even know. Like, well, you do, you know, actually. I know what I'm saying.
No, I mean, I don't know, but I know what went down. Like, I mean, it must have been just like super like, ritualistic.
Yeah, and you know, coming from behind the orange curtain, you know, like it, you know, parts of it sucked down there, but there was a lot of interesting, I mean, because it sucked, interesting stuff comes up. Like every time there's a sidewalk, you know, little weeds start growing through. So I remember seeing like Doggy Style and Heavy Dirt, you know, playing in Placentia at a roller rink or something, you know, going to Safari Sam's or Big John's and, you know, all these different places and Huntington Beach. And, you know, there was a lot of punk rock, you know, for sure. That was great.
You know, it's really easy to get to Silver Lake by the bus. I mean, if you're coming from North Hollywood, all you got to do is, you know, get on the Lancashire Red Line station where the Red Line starts and take it southbound. Just get on the side that says Union Station and take it all the way to Sunset in Vermont. And then when you get off, come up on a surface street, get on the number 2 and it takes you right there. through Silver Lake. It's really simple. It's just, you know, one train, one bus.
Yeah, I love Silver Lake. And, I'm not even, if you look at me, my jeans are not skinny and whatever. But
well, tell us about your favorite places to eat in Silver Lake.
Well, first of all, I think food isn't that great in Silver Lake. Okay. Like, Ginger Grash is always so crowded, but I swear it's not that good. It is not that good.
That's fine.
Someone should open a kick-ass restaurant on that street because there's like this, there's a taco truck and that's it. And I have to backtrack a little bit because I know the Cha-Cha's there and a lot of people really love that place. I went there, I don't drink, so I have no reason to go there. But I went there for a record swap because Mario Rubalcaba was like selling records. So I had to go say hi.
That's awesome.
And he's bitching. I bought some Agent Orange records off him.
Oh, cool.
But I never go to that bar, but I swear, 3 days out of the week, there's always like all this crap in front of my house, like plates with leftover burritos and cigarette butts and bottles, and it pisses me off. So like, it's like I have this love-hate relationship because I see all of Atiba's, photos on Instagram about them all partying and raging and having a good time.
Right.
And then I have all this crap in front of my house the next day, and so it's weird. Like, it adds to the mystique of my neighborhood and it makes it cooler, but it also kind of sucks at the same time. These guys that can't park and they're like blocking our driveway and leaving shit in front of it.
Well, they should be taking the bus to Silver Lake.
Exactly.
And not, traveling in the metal coffin, wasting their gas and time and disrupting peaceful residents like yourself.
Yeah, see, that's why everyone should listen to this podcast for that wisdom.
So let's talk about being a family man and, people in that situation, like maybe just want to go with their wife or child or children. Where's a good place to take them in Silver Lake to maybe go be outdoors? Let's talk about that.
Well, I think that the Meadow is a good place, man.
Okay.
I know dog owners hate it because there's like a no dog policy, but I think it's rad being able to walk barefoot and not step in crap.
Right.
I think that's a really positive thing. People don't do that much in LA.
Sure.
What's funny is we have actually, since the Meadow's opened, we've had a lot of kites land in our backyard.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, do you mind it?
No, the thing is that my daughter, who's four, she's like, why do we get these ugly kites? Because we'll get like these Avatar blue skin dudes falling and, they're all these dude kites. And she's like, where's the cool rainbow kite or something?
Right.
You
know? So there's like a little like a spike in kite popularity.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Kites are back and I'm all for it. They're very.
What about Frisbees?
I think that would be. Yeah, Frisbee. I'm pro Frisbee. I draw the line at hacky sacks, probably.
Yeah, dude. Like, hacky sack is like rollerblades to me, dude. I don't do hacky sack. I don't do rollerblades. I don't do fanny packs.
You know what's weird? There's this one ledge on Silver Lake Boulevard.
I don't do Crocs, dude.
Dude, I see rollerbladers doing this one ledge, and it freaks me out. I'm like, whoa, there's rollerbladers here. Like, it seems, and out in broad daylight, I'm like, wow, you never see rollerbladers doing anything. And then here they are, like, in broad daylight, right in front of me. Like, I don't know what to say,
Yeah, that's kind of odd.
It's bold. I respect them for flying the flag and everything. Right. But I'm like, wow, these guys are like Encino Man, frozen out of, just coming out of nowhere.
Time machine sport, dude.
Yeah, you do not expect to see that.
I remember when I had a half pipe in Whittier, I would, like, write all kinds of bad stuff about rollerbladers, like, no rollerbladers allowed. And, but I would let them come in for a while and, just, all right, you guys got to leave
and
now.
And then you give them an old skateboard on the way out and say, here, you can learn. You must learn, like as KRS-One would say.
Get used to it.
Yeah.
No, but okay, so we learned that your personal taste. I mean, you've been residing in Silver Lake for how many years?
Well, so 97. Okay. Is that what I said? 97 or so?
Yeah. So in your opinion, the food is not good there. My opinion? I feel the same.
Silver Lake Ramen's all right. I went there, just opened like a couple months ago.
My opinion, there's no good food there. I mean, worth stopping off. I mean, if you fall into it, fine, but don't go out of your way for it.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, I go to San Gabriel Valley for
that's
Asian
what I want
food.
To talk about. Okay. You're vegetarian?
Right. Yeah.
Are you vegan?
No.
Vegetarian?
Yes.
Okay, Asian food. You're Asian. Mm-hmm. You're talking San Gabriel Valley, Monterey Park, Alhambra.
Yeah.
Talk about, share some of your favorite places.
The thing is, vegetarian food in the US, like it has a very limited history. Like hippies came up with it basically. So you get things like nut loaf, lentil things. And it's food for people who wear Birkenstocks and stuff. And it's not good. It's just like hippie food. But you think about the
so it's
extra,
like for peppermint patty, right?
Yeah. But then I love peanuts and peppermint patty, but that food sucks.
Yeah.
But then you think about Chinese culture though, thousands of years older. Think of these monks that have been vegetarian for all this extra time to come up with rad ways to eat food. So you get these vegetarian Chinese places where they actually, they'll make a mock meat. They'll like totally bind up sheets of bean curd and then wrap it in seaweed to simulate the skin and texture, and it just like unfolds in your mouth, and it's so good. And there's like these mock, you know, Kung Pao chicken or whatever made out of mushrooms that are deep fried and crispy on the outside and soft on the inside. And man, I love it. You know, I just found a place, I think it's called like Nice Garden or Tasty Garden.
What city is it in?
Well, first of all, I guess backtracking, the ones I was talking about before,
okay.
you'd have to go to a place like Happy Family,
okay,
or Vegetarian Gourmet. Where's right. Vegetarian? You know, there's a couple of places that...
What city, though?
Oh, these are all like Monterey Park, Alhambra.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know what? When I was a kid, I used to go to Paul's Kitchen in Monterey Park.
Oh, dude, that is total ABC, like... Yeah, first generation Chinese American food. Like did they give you the tomato beef chow mein that tastes like ketchup sort of?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, I had a discussion with my mom about this. It tasted so ketchupy, and I loved the taste that I would put ketchup on the white steamed rice.
Dude, that's because total. That's total Chinese American comfort food.
Totally.
Yeah, like when we would go to banquets, like the grownups would have the real Chinese food, and then we'd get the tomato beef chow mein, we'd get chow fun, and then we'd get like a big 2-liter. Thing of Sunkist, like that was the kids' table, you know, every time. But now, you know, I go to these vegetarian Chinese places, and they rule. You know, they're so good, and you know, you could get like 8 courses of crazy mock meats,
and the prices are good, right?
Oh yeah, I mean, if you spend more than $10 a person, that's outrageous, you know. And the food, and I found a place that has dim sum. Finally, okay. Yeah, I used to go to this place, in Hawaii. Every time I go to Honolulu, like there's this place that has vegetarian dim sum. And I finally found one in LA, and I'm super psyched on it. So, you know, usually when I go, I love the ritual. You know, you get the tea, you get don tot, and, you know, which is like the egg tarts.
Right.
The little bean bows with the sesames outside, the jin doi. Then everything, after that, everything is meat, pretty much. It's all meat. You know, whether it's sumai or,
right.
You know, all that stuff. It's all pork and chicken or whatever. And I love the ritual, but I can only eat the sweet stuff. Then I feel like crap afterwards. I'm lucky that my in-laws will like order, you know, some of the sheet noodles without meat for me just because they're super cool and they'll do that. But man, to find vegetarian dim sum was like the raddest thing.
So you would say like, you know, if you're you want serious Asian vegetarian, go to the San Gabriel Valley, Monterey Park, Alhambra, places out there.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And you know, sometimes you'll like be sitting there and then a monk will come in and sit next to you.
Really?
Yeah. Or Katie Lang, you know, whatever. It's like, it's really? Rad. Yeah. It's bitching.
So do you have any names of these places?
Oh yeah. So absolutely. Happy Family Rules.
Okay.
That one's on Atlantic, just north of... Oh man, it's south of Valley, of the 10.
So that's Alhambra,
it's in
right?
the big, you know where that big Times Square is? There's like a big movie theater that shows Hong Kong movies sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that there's a Happy Family in there. And then on Valley, have you ever heard of San Gabriel Square? It's like on San Gabriel and Valley. It's like this big center with there's a 99 Ranch Market. And,
yep.
You know, it's gigantic. It's like 2 stories tall. Yep. It's all neon. You feel like you're in Taiwan or something.
Absolutely.
But yeah, that's where Gourmet Vegetarian is. And that place has the raddest cold plates. Where they'll have like these fake, sea anemone type things on right. their cold plate that are really badass. So I dig that place too.
So we got a caller. Let's take the call. Hello, Los Angeles Nisa. You're on the air with Martin Wong.
Hey, Martin and Eddie. This is Greg. And this is an awesome show. And I wanted to ask if Martin, you wanted to share any like incredible moments in Los Angeles history, like for music or just when all these different, I mean, music and art or other things might have come together.
Dude,
for example, like maybe when Xene was playing with the Go-Go's or something like that, you know?
Well, I got to say that, first of all, like sports-wise, no other, you know, to have had Magic Johnson and Wayne Gretzky, Kareem, Kobe, like...
Steve Garvey,
yep.
Davey Lopes.
Oral Hershiser.
All simultaneously.
Kofax. Yeah, but that era that you're talking about was incredible. Like I had a poster with Wayne and Magic on either side of the forum in my room. And this was like when I was in college, you know, because even though I was too old to have athletes, those guys were such heroes and so awesome, like representatives of humanity.
You're right, you know, about that.
Yeah. I was
the sportsmanship was amazing.
Yeah. So, but like when that, as for that crossing over with music, I remember seeing Thelonious Monster open for the Chili Peppers at the John Anson Ford. And it must've been like, after one of the OD, I can't remember which OD it was after, but I think
was that with the Fishbone and at the Palace?
No. I'm thinking of the Giants and Ford. So I remember it was '88, okay. Right after the Dodgers won the World Series.
Okay.
And
Kirk Gibson.
Yeah, yeah. And Bob Forrest came out and said, the Dodgers won the World Series. And if you don't like that, fuck you. You know, this is the greatest thing to ever happen.
That rules.
And imagine seeing the Chili Peppers and Thelonious Monster. The Dodgers won. It's like just L.A.
Yeah.
You know, that's like
L.A. bands just like rising up. And like just the spirit of the teams.
Oh yeah,
at
yeah.
the time.
Yeah, at that time, imagine like you know the Chili Peppers and X and Firehose, and this is all coming out of you know the SST era. Man, LA was and still is the best place for music.
It is
in the world by far. You know, London.
I can't subscribe to the Angels. I can't subscribe to the Ducks. I just can't take it serious.
Oh yeah.
You know, I can't, it just pains me to go see, even to go to the Honda Center.
Oh.
I mean, like I went to all three Van Halen shows last June. Okay. I went to one at the Honda Center and two at Staples Center, and like Orange County is just so much different. Like seeing the same show, it's just like, it's, I don't know.
Yeah.
That's all I'm going
to
say.
Although, you know, I went to see Bruce Springsteen at the Pond like a couple months ago.
Right.
And maybe, you know, it was weird because I walked in and I felt like, wow, this is like the Republican convention or something, looking around. But then, you know, there were like the most boring, whatever looking people around, like car salesmen and CEOs and whatever. But man, like to see them just like, just believe in Bruce, you know, and him leading them like this.
That's
religious
pretty inspiring.
Experience. Like that was rad. And I'd imagine in LA it was cool too, but it was more like Hollywood, you know, in LA. So I was kind of like him talking to the regular people. And then, okay, here's the best part. He brought out Mike Ness to sing. And then he brought out, dude, who's the guy from Rage Against? Tom Morello.
Right.
So he, like Bruce Springsteen, like who's, you know, the
boss.
Baddest, he's the boss. He brought out two Orange County punks on the stage to play for all these squares. So, you know, Mike Ness didn't sit in on a boss song. They sang Bad Luck, a Social Distortion song.
Oh, they played a Social D song.
And that is intense, right? That Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band would cover Social Distortion.
Sure.
Yeah, and then Tom Morello, you know, yeah, I know. I guess they're kind of LA Eagle Rock or whatever, but man, they're Irvine. So,
yeah.
So for him to come out and like, you know, he's an activist and he's a believer and he works his ass off for a cause. So I think it's rad that he would like foist these, you know, rabble rousers onto like this, you know, kind of conservative crowd.
Greg, where are you calling from?
San Diego.
Are you ever lived in Los Angeles?
You know, I come to LA all the time, and it's like I go there on vacation on weekends sometimes.
Awesome.
Love it. Okay, keep up the awesome show.
Hey, thank you so much for calling.
Yeah, thanks.
Hey, we're going to take a break and go into some music.
Totally. Okay, wait.
This is the Martin Wong exclusive playlist for Los Angeles Nista episode 11. And we're going to play a few more tunes here. Come back. Here we go.
It's all bad.
Welcome back to Los Angeles Nista, episode 11 with Giant Robots, Martin Wong. Martin, thank you for stopping by tonight.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I have a Silver Lake question for you.
Sure.
Since we're on that topic. Well, isn't there a Silver Lake like street fair, music festival in the summer?
There is one, huh?
Yeah.
I haven't even been there. I suck.
No, I saw Sonic. Okay, 2004, I saw Sonic Youth there.
Oh, the Sunset Junction.
Junction. Yeah.
I used to go to that. I saw Sonic Youth. I saw New York Dolls. The Wipers, I think.
Yeah, those were...
They had some killer shows.
They had great stage production. It was free. Great environment and great acts. Now, every experience I've had at the Sunset Junction Festival has been great. Why isn't it happening anymore?
I think there was some shadiness between the person who ran it and the money, and it didn't go to the community like it was supposed to.
Is that true?
That's what I've read. Yeah, and all these people, like bands were owed money, and yeah, it was kind of bad. It sucks because they had all these great bands, and I loved it, especially because my in-laws actually live right up the street.
Oh, so that's like you could post up there.
Yeah, so right? So like, you know, it's permit parking. We would get free wristbands. You know, and I would see Built to Spill for free. You know, it was awesome.
Oh, so residents get free passes.
Yeah. They'd get a couple of free passes for dealing with, you know, all the craziness.
I remember when your X played also.
Yeah, I went to that one.
Was that great?
Oh, man, to see X in Los Angeles at a street fair, that's how it should be, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it just seems like that area, you know, it's just too bad that it couldn't be maintained for such a thriving area. Don't you agree?
Yeah, but it was so big and so crazy. It's kind of nice that, you know, you can still walk down though and see, go to Vacation Vinyl.
That's the best.
You know, get Pazzo Gelato, get some comics at Secret Headquarters, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Army Navy store is still there from falling down. There's still, I like the vegan place is pretty rad, Floor or whatever.
Yeah.
That place is all right.
You know, it's a good place I've eaten at many times with my friends that are into that kind of thing, but the Raw Foods place, Crew.
You know, I went there on like date night with my wife. You know, we thought we'd check it out.
Did you like it?
It's expensive.
Very expensive.
And you leave hungry.
Exactly.
But, you know, it's righteous. You know, I'm all for it, you know.
Right.
But
right.
Man, it's not my thing, I have to say.
So if one of my listeners through Los Angeles and he still wanted to get some information from you, what pearls of wisdom would you have to say to them about Silver Lake? If they wanted to know, okay, I'm going to be there for one day. What should I do?
Oh, well, you should go to all those, you know, I would go to Rockaway and see if there's any finds, you know, because their vinyl is pretty affordably priced,
right,
I think.
Right.
I would go to Vacation.
Right.
You know, check out the records.
What about
there.
The Red Lion?
It's a little, you know, I don't drink, but I appreciate that you have women in Lederhosen serving you big steins of beer. I think that's great. I don't even eat meat, so I can't even appreciate the wieners, but I think... You know, as an institution, I think it's awesome.
Sure.
You know, I think there's like genuine, you know, it's not happy hour. It's happy decades. That place has been there forever. I think it's
absolutely
great.
And as far as what about the coffee?
Silver Lake coffee. I wish it was a little better. Oh, you know what I like is there's Cafecito Organico. That's pretty good.
Right.
They always have a table at the farmer's market on Tuesdays and Saturdays, I think. But yeah, they have all this free trade, you know, pretty rad coffee. Their packaging sucks now. But
and what about Exine Shop?
Is this, you got bad taste? Is that what you're talking about? Like, that's ancient history.
Is it?
Yeah, it was there. I remember when we had the Chinatown article on Giant Robot, I would go there and try to stalk, you know, Exine. And what happened was for the Chinatown article, we talked about Chinatown, but I wanted to talk about punk rock because of the Hong Kong Cafe. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I actually went to a couple shows there.
Same
here. I tried to see Gigi Allen, and it didn't happen.
Right.
I saw Rancid's second show ever, which was super awesome.
Yep.
But I interviewed Keith Morris and Exine, you know, at You Got Bad Taste. And, you know, I thought it was rad to have them in Giant Robot's Chinatown article.
Great. So that wraps it up for episode 11, Martin Wong, Giant Robot, Silver Lake, Los Angeles, Nista. Next week, we have Fredo Ortiz, great musician, his band, The Bongaloids, also known for his history with the Beastie Boys and Los Lobos, Tenacious D. The 18th, we got Ed Culver in here. This guy, I mean, shot the cover to Damaged. I mean, that's probably like one of the most significant album covers. Don't you think so?
Yeah, I think everyone should get Blight at the End of the Tunnel. Or I think Hardcore California showcases his stuff pretty well, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And these are books that everyone should have on their bookshelf.
And February 25th, we have James Rhoda. He's a producer of the new Dave Grohl film, Sound City Movie. And that does it. Martin, thank you very much. Everyone grab our podcast tomorrow and enjoy Martin's interview if you missed it.
Thanks.
signing off.